Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tomorrow, the Catholic Church and the world will witness an unusual changing of the guard as Pope Benedict XVI steps down from a seat that was promised to him for life. It is the first time in nearly 600 years that a pope has resigned. But atop the shock of his announcement a few weeks ago is the continuing saga of controversy that swirls in and around the Vatican, indeed around the world, of the larger Catholic Church. Joining us now by phone from Puerto Rico to talk about all of that is Michael Winters. He's an American journalist and writer who covers events in the Roman Catholic Church for the National Catholic Reporter. Michael, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking a break on your vacation.
Glad to be with you, Ann.
Also joining us in the studio is Professor Leo Madden. Leo is an associate professor of Catholic theology at Ohio Dominican University here in Columbus. He is also director of the Master's in Theology program, as well as the head of the undergraduate theology program. Welcome to the show, Professor Madden.
I'm happy to be here.
Michael, when Pope Benedict announced a few weeks ago that he would retire, I remember where I was when he announced that, and a lot of people will say they remember where they were. It was, in its own way, a stop-the-presses moment. But as New York Times columnist Frank Bruni noted last week, most of the Roman Catholic world is somewhat nonplussed by the turn of affairs. So there's a sort of this duality. Some of us are, you know, riveted to the whole experience and the whole topic. Others are like, big deal, I didn't care what the Pope said anyways. What about that, Michael Winters? Is there a story there?
Well, I would never rely on Frank Bruni for anything to do with the Catholic Church, because I think he's got some big axes to grind. But that said, I would compare it to this debate over the sequester, where as the sequestration takes effect, certainly certain government officials and people who work for the government are going to feel it immediately. But it will take a little bit of time before the restaurants that they frequent or the movie theaters that they go to, that they will feel it. And so certainly for the upper echelons of the church, other cardinals, bishops, things like that, anyone who has pressing issues in front of the Vatican, it really is a stop-the-presses moment. All appointments cease. Every major office in the Vatican Curia lapses tomorrow. It's not just the Pope who resigns. There is no Cardinal Secretary of State. There is no Prefect of the Congregation for Bishops. Their offices all lapse, and it's up to the new Pope to reappoint them or appoint someone else. On the other hand, lower down the food chain of the church, you know, people are still going to Mass. They still are not going to eat meat on Friday. These things continue no matter who the Pope is and whether there is a Pope.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Michael Winters, columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, and also in the studio with us, Professor Leo Madden of the Ohio Dominican University. Professor Madden, what about that kind of dual experience a lot of people are seeing out there regarding this?
It depends on how closely one followed the previous papacy, John Paul II, and one followed the thought and life of Pope Benedict. Whether one was a Catholic or not, we remember John Paul II and how he declined and died on the world stage for many years. And this continued the expectation by everyone, Catholics and non-Catholics alike, that the person who occupies the office of the Bishop of Rome occupies that office until natural death. This is how it's been done, as you know, for centuries. Now, suddenly, the announcement is that Pope Benedict is abdicating. This was a surprise to everyone. But those who had followed Benedict and those who had known something about church law knows that the possibility of this was always there in church law. The procedures are going to that begin tomorrow are the same procedures as if the Pope had passed away. There will be an empty chair of St. Peter, and then all the other procedures will take place. And furthermore, those who had followed, my last point, those who had followed the thought of Pope Benedict knew that the desire to retire had been in his heart for decades. He had asked to retire from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith many times, and Pope John Paul II refused his requests. So this is an act, as everyone sees, as an act of humility on his part. He recognizes that the office of the Petrine ministry is greater than his own personality, his own physical stamina can support at this moment. and we should be grateful for his years of service to the church, both as Pope and previously.
Michael Winters, getting back to what Professor Madden said, if you're following it closely, in a way you wouldn't be surprised. So why was everyone surprised, or why the element of surprise in the decision? Why would the Pope not say, you know, I'm thinking about this, like other people might, in like we knew, say, for instance, since you brought up government, Hillary Clinton, people knew that Hillary Clinton was very seriously thinking that she's going to step down now with the second administration when the president was reelected. But the Pope doesn't do that.
Right. It's a different kind of a hierarchy in which, you know, as we've already seen since he announced, you know, there's been some score settling. The knives have been drawn. You know, had he been openly speculating it, that process might have started sooner, and it would have been very ugly, as it's kind of ugly now. I think Professor Madden is exactly right, that this shows a very different spirituality that Benedict has regarding the office of the Pope from that of John Paul II. I mean, I don't want to say that John Paul was a narcissist, but clearly there was this side of him that he felt, you know, he was destined by God to be the Pope and filled the role, and that he tied it in with his sense of, you know, Polish destiny and all this. Benedict had none of that. And, I'm told by Vatican insiders, did not want to be elected Pope, at times voiced questions whether he had been right to accept his election in 2005. So it was not an entire surprise. But whenever it happens, of course, it's a surprise. I mean, you know, and the timing, there's been a lot of speculation about the timing. I suspect it's not more complicated than the fact that one of the themes of Benedict's papacy is that the principal role of a pope is to lead the church in prayer. And he knew Holy Week was coming up. And it is a brutal schedule if you're sitting in the pews. But if you have to lead two services on Holy Thursday and two services on Good Friday, and a late night service on Holy Saturday, and an early morning service on Easter Sunday morning, and then the Urbi et Orbi blessing, I think he just felt, you know, I'm not up to that. And clearly this has been a central theme of his pontificate, is that the Pope's job is not so much to be a manager, but to be, the man who leads the church in prayer, and that he was just no longer up to that.
Is the actual essence of his abdication, Professor Madden, some say it signals a new modern church, that it's reflective of a more modern church now?
I wouldn't put it that way, but it does raise a number of very practical questions. Some of them were dealt with the last couple of days from the papal spokesperson, Father Lombardi. What do you call an ex-pope? Where does an ex-pope live? What authority does an ex-pope have? What formal clothes does an ex-pope wear? These are all questions that we've never had to even ponder. And as we go forward, the question in my mind, quite frankly, is whether this will begin a precedent for future popes. Certainly, I think it will have this effect as the cardinals meet in conclave when they consider the criteria. Whom will they choose as the next Bishop of Rome? And I think one of them will be, we had better ratchet back the age when the individual begins his papacy. Because Pope Benedict XVI began his papacy as an elderly man. He was 78, one of the very oldest ever elected pope. And he was in excellent health, and people knew that his family had longevity genes. But the next pope, the cardinals may, in the general criteria of whom to select, they may say, we better select someone who's younger.
Well, there is that long pope, short pope,
yes,
tenure thing. Michael Winters, is there any pattern over time that we've seen of, one leading longer and then the decision being made that, maybe that guy was too old, we got to go younger next time?
I think that they generally, of course, it doesn't always work out that way. They elected Leo XIII in 1878, and he also was an elderly pope, and he lived to be until 1903. I mean, he had the second longest papacy at that time. So,
you never know.
It doesn't always play out. Yeah, exactly. But I do think the professor's right that, you know, it's not so much the long pope, short pope, as it is the fat pope, thin pope.
Yeah, I've heard that, too.
Which is after a fat pope, a thin pope. So we've just had someone from the Vatican Curia who was very soft-spoken, very shy and retiring. They may want someone a little bit more gregarious. And someone, you know, one of the key differences between John Paul and Benedict, if you're a cardinal, is John Paul at lunchtime, you know, there were 12 people at lunch every lunch. There were 12 people at dinner every dinner. This was not Benedict's way. And so I think there will be a desire to have someone who's perhaps a little bit more accessible and not just younger, but a little bit more open to getting a wide range of advisors. You know, by the time Benedict was elected, he knew who he could trust. He knew he didn't have a lot of time. So he put key people in certain positions, and they were there. And Cardinal Bertone, for instance, is number two, the Secretary of State, has also asked to resign repeatedly. And Benedict has said, no, while I stay, you stay. And there's been a great deal of frustration that Cardinal Bertone was not the most effective Secretary of State, that the trains were not running on time. So the advantage of having, say, someone in their mid-60s would be to be a little bit more on top of their own game. So if they end up with a Secretary of State who's not working out, and you know, they don't want to live with that for 10 years, so they'd make a change. And so I think you will see those kinds of considerations in the conclave based on the experience of Benedict. And the experience of John Paul, I think the one of the reasons Benedict chose this task is the last few years of John Paul's reign were not a happy time for the church. He was so severely incapacitated, and people around him who were not pope, who had not been elected to this job, became very, very powerful and made some very, very bad decisions. The effort to cover up the crimes of Father Maciel, the head of the Legionnaires, being the most obvious example. And they don't want to ever go through that again. And the idea that a papal secretary would be controlling all access, that's not a healthy period in the life of the church. And Benedict, to his great credit, said, I'm not going to put the church through that.
Sounds like a Dan Brown novel or something. Professor Madden, Pope Benedict has been described as charming, though. Not gregarious. What's the distinction for you in that sense? In what way is he charming, if not having a big dinner party every night?
He's charming in an intellectual sense. In a small group, even on a large group, on a large stage in St. Peter's Square or in front of large crowds when he spoke at Westminster Hall in London or at university settings around the world. So it doesn't matter how large the audience is. Nevertheless, he is... what characterizes his work, and Mr. Winters can attest to this, is his ability to bring together so many important ideas and show their connection. He's intellectually nimble in that respect. He clearly identifies what is the issue. He is courageous in identifying what is the issue and is willing to confront his audience. That would make his audience often a little bit uncomfortable. And he shows the connection, for example, between theology and the political process, or the relationship between the use of reason and the use and our what we apprehend by faith. He's not naturally gregarious in the sense that he is a slap happy individual who gains strength by being in large crowds. I don't see that. He's not former President Bill Clinton in that respect. But he knows his mind, which is vast, and he's able to tap into enormous depths and reservoirs of knowledge, and he's able to teach audiences in a way that very, very few churchmen have ever been able to do.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fischel. We'll return to our discussion about the exit of Pope Benedict when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fischel on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Yahoo CEO and new mom Marissa Meyer says no more working from home for her staff. But wait, wasn't that the future? We'll investigate. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point is this afternoon from at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. 39 degrees with some rain showers off and on today. Possibly a snow shower as temperatures drop today. A little bit of snow for tonight, a low of 29 degrees. Some snow likely for Thursday, less than half an inch of accumulation, and a high of 36. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, helping seniors in their homes, hospital, independent, or assisted living facilities, wherever they call home. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. Tomorrow, the Catholic Church and the world witnesses an unusual changing of the guard as Pope Benedict steps down from his seat. It's the first time in nearly 600 years that a pope has resigned. Joining me to talk about that, the implications and some of the issues swirling around, Michael Sean Winters. He's a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter and the author of Left at the Altar, How the Democrats Lost the Catholics and How the Catholics Can Save the Democrats. And also Professor Leo Madden. He is a professor of theology and the head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. Welcome back to you both. As soon as he resigned, I'm sure I'm not the only journalist who was bombarded with emails and Facebook questions about a conspiracy. Someone even asked me about it on Words with Friends. Concerns that there's something more going on, that he's leaving before the other shoe drops. And Michael, you've already said you don't necessarily think that's the case, but there is stuff going on out there that is of concern.
Well, it wouldn't be a conspiracy to remove him, certainly by, say, any of his principal advisors, because so many of them lose their power when he steps off the stage.
Okay.
To the degree he felt that there is a need for some very meaningful reform to the Vatican Curia, and that he might not have the physical energy to make that happen, that it may need a new team, not just himself. And again, when you're 85 years old, the idea of bringing on a whole new set of assistants, learning their, how to interact with them and all that, would certainly be an odious prospect. So I wouldn't say there was any kind of conspiracy to get him out, so much as events may have conspired to lead him to conclude that the church needed someone a little younger, a little bit more vibrant, a little bit more energy, and capable of bringing in a new team to address some of these controversies that we've seen in the press the last few days.
For instance, the decision of, or the recent resignation of Cardinal Keith O'Brien, the UK's most senior Catholic, because of another sexual scandal. Leo Madden, what's the upshot of those kind of things? How does it distract?
Well, the upshot of this, and I'm sure this is among the criteria that the cardinals are concerned about, and I'm sure this definitely has weighed on the heart of Pope Benedict. It's that these allegations of clergy sex abuse sometimes come out of the blue. I mean, you don't know where the next explosion is going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
Will it be Scotland, as we've just found out? Will it be Los Angeles, which was a long simmering? Will it be Philadelphia, which was, again, a long simmering one? Will the next one be somewhere? It is impossible to. And so this is a concern that the Pope already having this burden on his heart, right? And seeing the decline in church attendance in certain parts of the world, especially in Ireland, as a result of these abuses, I think this is a very high criteria, an item on their agenda. We need a Bishop of Rome who has the energy and the ability to anticipate problems before they arise, and then to put in place procedures and personnel to make sure they don't happen again.
And of course, to certainly not be one of the problems.
No.
They need to pick someone without scandal. But how do they do that? Aren't they supposed to be talking about whether a candidate is spiritual enough for the job or something like that, Michael Winters?
Well, I think the first consideration for a cardinal is going to be, I mean, they're called princes of the church for a reason. Although, obviously, I think many of the cardinals are deeply spiritual men. They also, you know, have administrative jobs. They want to make sure that they can get the things that they need from the Vatican if they've not been able to get, for instance, an auxiliary bishop. If there's been an investigation that's been going on too long. You know, if their phone calls are not getting returned. You know, there was that great moment during Hurricane Sandy where President Obama and Governor Christie were standing next to each other, and the president said he had a 15-minute rule, that any call from Governor Christie had to be answered within 15 minutes. You know, the cardinals want those very kind of simple considerations. But I think in terms of the scandals, and we have to distinguish, you know, the Cardinal O'Brien situation in Scotland involved his own misdeeds. Mm-hmm. And I think those kinds of things, you know, who knows what people may have in their past. I think the more pervasive problem is the concern of covering up pedophile priests. And I think this is something where there's more likely to be a track record if there have been depositions. I mean, obviously, the civil courts are sometimes in the situation of Los Angeles.
Cardinal Roger Mahoney, by the way, right? That's what we're talking about there.
Right.
Yeah.
Cardinal Mahoney, who you know, it came out in these depositions and the discovery of certain documents, they were actively trying to cover up and, you know, priests who were pedophiles. No one has accused Cardinal Mahoney of himself being a pedophile or of any other sexual misconduct. So these are slightly different concerns in terms of how they're going to manifest themselves in the life of the church. I do suspect, given this aura of crisis and confusion at the Vatican and that the trains haven't been running on time and that we've not really gotten our head in front of the around this problem and dealt with it once and for all, I suspect the principal criteria for the good of the church that the cardinals will be looking for is somebody with a track record of dealing with crisis, of cleaning up a mess. It may not be the sex abuse mess. It may have been a financial crisis. But the person that they're looking at, the prospective pope, does he have it in his background? Was he sent to a very difficult situation, and did he handle it well? Whereas somebody who has not dealt with this situation of clergy sex abuse well would simply be impossible. I mean, the nightmare scenario is they elect someone, and 2 weeks later, you know, you find out some documents that they were covering up a priest pedophile. That would be just a disaster for the church. So I think they're going to be pretty strong in scrutinizing that kind of thing. I'll give you a very concrete example. Last week, Cardinal Dolan, who I think some people were mentioning as a potential pope, mm-hmm. I think it's always unlikely it would be an American, but he's very gregarious. He's you know, kind of a happy warrior type person. He had a 3-hour deposition in a sex abuse case in Milwaukee. He's never going to be elected, you know, unless they know what was in that deposition. Because that deposition will be public someday, and they know that. And it's one thing to have that for the Cardinal Archbishop of New York. It's another thing for the Pope.
It's an appearance of impropriety, if nothing else. It sounds more and more
like... just tainted. They
right.
just want somebody who's not even tainted with it.
Right.
Or, even better, somebody like the other American who's getting mentioned, Sean O'Malley, who went into Boston after Cardinal Law and the meltdown in 2002 and cleaned it up. You know, I mean, he certainly is the only reason he's being mentioned. I mean, it's not because he's an American. I suspect if he were not an American, he would be the front runner going into this conclave precisely because he went into this impossible situation in Boston, which had huge financial considerations and all this. And he really, you know, addressed the crisis, turned the situation around, and the church in Boston is thriving. There, for the first time in decades, the school enrollment in Catholic schools is going up, not by a lot, but it's not declining mm-hmm. as it is in so many other places. Their finances have been turned around. The priest morale is good. Their seminary is filled with seminarians. There's not an empty room in their seminary. Mm-hmm. And he's really turned that situation around. So if there's another cardinal who's not an American who can bring that to the table, there's your next pope.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'd like to hear from you, 614-292-8513. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Leo Madden of Ohio Dominican University. Sounds like they're talking about hiring a CEO.
I just want to jump in and agree 100% with what Mr. Winters just said in regard to the vast unlikelihood of Cardinal Dolan, but also the likelihood of Cardinal O'Malley. And I just want to remind the viewers and listeners of the very practical set of thought process that the Cardinals will undertake, and that is whoever is chosen Bishop of Rome has to gain 67% of the Cardinals in the room. And so whoever is chosen will have to be, in some respects, a consensus candidate.
A supermajority.
A supermajority. Okay. It has to be a consensus candidate. And the skills that Mr. Winters just talked about certainly has to be present. Another criterion that has to be present, and this is, from what I read, this is the first question that they ask one another when they gather, when they chit-chat with one another, is, does the person exhibit personal holiness? And lately, a lot of commentators on the Catholic scene have encouraged transparency, that we need, that the Vatican Curia, the Vatican, you know, bureaucracy needs to be more transparent. But I can assure your audience that the Cardinals are looking at that kind of transparency, the transparency of personal holiness, a life of prayer that is evident without any effort on the part of the Bishop of Rome when they speak to people individually or to large crowds. And that's what was, among many things, that was what was attractive to Pope Benedict. It was clear that here we had an individual who was personally in on a regular basis, daily basis, hourly basis, in touch with the living faith of the risen Jesus.
We have an email from Mary in Clintonville. She describes herself as a recovering Catholic. A lot of us have heard that description before. She writes, if President Obama retired suddenly because of illness, not only his PR person, but the medical doctors would have been there to confirm the president's decision. The American people would have demanded it, as should the Catholics demand that of him. I assume she's referring to the Pope. He is no different a situation than Joe Paterno was. Going into hiding is only to hide his shame, and the Vatican will protect him. What kills me are the few I have met that don't feel he should be punished if found guilty for a mass cover-up. It is not just Catholics. All organized religion was started by men. I think it is truly a male problem more than it is a religious thing. With that, it is time women run the Vatican. A lot of issues brought up there, but the idea of a Vatican cover-up, Michael Winters, he's going to retire briefly to the summer house of the Vatican. I guess they call it the Camp David of the Vatican, and then go into relative seclusion for a long time. Is that protecting him from something or giving him what he's yearned for most of his life?
Yeah, first of all, the idea that Benedict has in any way tried to cover up the sex abuse crisis is simply not supported by the facts. In throughout the 1980s and 1990s, one of the problems that the Vatican had in dealing with the sex abuse crisis was that it was not sure which cabinet agency had jurisdiction. And in 2001, knowing that Joseph Ratzinger was his most competent administrator, John Paul II decided all those sex abuse cases go to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which was then Cardinal Ratzinger's job. So he, by the time he was elected in 2005, had gone through every single dossier of every single priest who was accused of this and dealt with the issue of whether we defrocked them or not. There is no one on the planet who knew more about it, no one on the planet who did more, even as a cardinal, to try to get the Vatican to focus on this. He did the investigation of Father Maciel and wanted to have John Paul move against Father Maciel and was stopped by other cardinals. But, you know, the idea that somehow there's any personal cover-up by Benedict, there's simply no factual evidence for that. And I think the idea of women running the church, I'm not going to address it. You know, that won't happen in my lifetime. But I think there's it remains to be seen how this will play out. I was with someone yesterday who had seen the Holy Father in December. and said, when you get up close, he really is very, very frail. And I don't know how many years he will have left to him. Of course, German engineering is built to last. but on the other hand, we also, all of these things that Father Lombardi was saying Monday in the press conference about he's going to live here, he's going to wear this, he's going to be called this, that's all conditional, because in 2 weeks we're going to have a new pope.
Uh-huh.
And if he comes in and says, you know, Benedict, thank you for your years of service, but I would rather you be at this monastery I found for you in Germany, then Benedict is going to Germany. I mean, this is, you know, he will take a vow of obedience to the new pope. And I suspect Benedict in his heart of hearts will be enormously solicitous. He will not do anything, whether he's living in the Vatican, whether he's living somewhere else. He will not speak out of school. He will not speak out of turn. I would suspect, however, that any pope who is elected in a couple weeks would be well advised to keep him close enough that you can consult him. I mean, you know, it's this strange relationship that develops between people like Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. because, you know, they're the, you know, only a few handful of people know what it's like to sit, you know, at the center desk in the Oval Office. And there's a bond there. And I think one of the nice things about this resignation is the incoming pope will have somebody else he can talk to about this burden and say, oh, my God, what, you know, what did you think? How did you have a situation that was similar? And this may be turn out to be a great, great blessing for the church and for the, especially for the new incoming pope.
Leo Madden?
Yes. Let me just address one issue that was raised in that email. The notion of a conspiracy of silence, a conspiracy of like-minded people, a conspiracy of people who were willing to hide the Pope Benedict behind the closed doors of the Vatican. Let me just tell the audience that the tradition of investigative journalism in Italy is very strong. And because there is the official organ of public relations from the Vatican, the Osservatore Romano and so forth. But all the other major newspapers are made up of individuals who are, well, Catholic in name only, if not anti-Catholic. And so they do not hesitate to track down and think. And in fact, if there is any excess in journalism towards the Catholic Church in Rome, it's the excess of seeing conspiracies everywhere, that this individual is representing one cluster of power-hungry individuals, and this individual is opposing another agenda item. So if there is any smoke, you know, after the election, right? If there's any smoke of scandal associated with the former Pope Benedict, the Pope Benedict XVI Emeritus, the journalistic culture of Italy will find it.
When we return, we're going to talk about a couple of those issues, the Pope's butler, the Vatican Bank. So stay with us. My guests, Michael Winters, columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, and also Professor Leo Madden of the Ohio Dominican University. Will be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
As governors gathered in Washington, President Obama seized the moment to lobby them on the looming sequester.
I hope that you speak with your congressional delegation and remind them in no uncertain terms exactly what is at stake.
I'm Neil Conan, Ken Rudin, our political junkie on the March 1st deadline and election results from Illinois, actual votes. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 here on 89.7 NPR News. And later today, it's Wellness Wednesday. Stay right here in 20 minutes. It begins at 11 o'clock with struggles to learn more about rare diseases. That's Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. A chance of rain for today. Temperatures also dropping, bringing a chance of a little snow. And some snow showers for tonight as well, a low of 29 degrees. Less than half an inch of accumulation is possible tomorrow, a high of 36. Support comes from CATCO. The 2010 Tony Award-winning play Red celebrates the life and vision of artist Mark Rothko as he and his assistant prepare the enormous canvases for the Four Seasons restaurant. On stage February 13th through March 3rd at the Rife Center. Details and tickets at catco.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about the resignation of Pope Benedict XVI. Steps down tomorrow. If you have a question or comment for our guests, Michael Winters, columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, and Professor Leo Madden of Ohio Dominican University, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Tom and Gahanna. He asks, what is going on with the Vatican Bank? Seems like we've had 40 years of scandal. The Pope just appointed a new manager of the bank, a German. Will things get better at the bank, or will the new Pope inherit a mess? Any thoughts, Michael Winters?
I think, you know, they've been making efforts to make that more transparent. You know, obviously it's not a bank like other banks in many ways. Its whole purpose, you know, we always use, because we're stuck with the language, the Pope is a CEO and he's a manager and things like this. You know, but at the end of the day, the church is not a business. I mean, the purpose of the Vatican Bank is, you know, to facilitate the charities and the works of the church. So, you know, they're not trying to make a profit. So I think, you know, certainly there was a culture at the Vatican that said, oh, no prying eyes allowed unless you're a cardinal. I think they have understood in the 21st century that has to change, that people's expectations have changed. Popes are celebrities in a way that they were not in the 19th or the 18th century. And so the Vatican certainly has to come up to date. There have obviously been some difficulties with that. But I think they're taking the steps. I think that train is on the right track. It's got a few more stations to go before it gets home. But I don't think that's going to be an overwhelming concern for the cardinals as they gather to make their choice, nor an overriding problem for the new pope.
And Leo Madden, last May, the pope's butler was arrested and charged with having stolen and leaked papal correspondence. I mean, once again, the image of Dan Brown rears its, rears in my mind. What's going on?
Well, in that case, it was a matter of an individual who did have a great personal affection for the pope. And he wanted to find some means of getting news to the Pope in a way that would shield himself from personal harm. And so he spirited away some documents and arranged for them to be made public in another way. This is what Mr. Winters was talking about earlier, in that whoever is Pope needs to bring in individuals whom he can trust and respect. And this is the need for somebody new who can bring in his own grouping of advisors and assistants.
We have an email from Brad in Columbus. He writes, from my perspective as a Catholic, I was disappointed in the choice of Benedict to lead the church. Following the vibrant example of John Paul II, skiing, exercising, traveling, and being embraced by all, I am concerned that the influence of Benedict will lead the cardinals to select another person who primarily represents the old guard, instead of putting in place some changes that would make the faith more relevant to today's world. If the former pope is still alive and presumably looking on, the cardinals will likely select someone who thinks like the former pope. Wouldn't it be a great criticism of Benedict to select someone completely different? First of all, Michael Winters, is Pope Benedict generally considered someone of the old guard per se? He's given a lot of credit, for instance, for bringing back and actually making something more of Vatican II when it comes to how people practice their faith.
Yeah, no, I think he, you know, certainly is a son of Vatican II, a creature of Vatican II, in its entirety, with a very distinctive, and once he was elected Pope, a very authoritative interpretation of what Vatican II was about and what it was not about. Old guard, new guard, you know, I'm a little reluctant to use those things. I mean, I thought this Holy Father, you know, says something about our media culture. You know, anytime he's talking about anything even vaguely sexually related, same-sex marriage, abortion, anything like that, obviously that's going to get all the headlines. On the other hand, you know, his World Day of Peace message, in January, where he talked about threats to world peace. And the first three he named were unregulated financial capitalism, terrorism, and international crime. Now, you can imagine if Barack Obama had lumped unregulated financial capitalism with terrorism as a threat to world peace, Fox News would talk about nothing else for a week. And this barely got mentioned. And yet this was, you know, one of the very key themes of Benedict's teaching was a deep suspicion of modern consumer capitalism. But, you know, we Americans, we don't really want to hear that because it includes a call to convert our lifestyle and to not indulge our luxuries. Now, here I am, you know, talking to you from Puerto Rico, where I come every year for my birthday. But, you know,
happy birthday.
I understand the sympathy, but the disposition of our minds. But, you know, this, he was saying that. The question is, were we hearing it, or can we hear it anymore? I think one of the reasons the church is growing in the third world is Benedict very clearly understood and very, as Professor Madden said, was very effectively preached the gospel at its core, which is about good news for the poor. And so I think in the third world, the church grows because they can still hear the gospel in ways that we in the West, with all of our luxuries, where if you've got a problem, you know, you can go to a supermarket and, you know, there's a 30-foot long aisle with nothing but hair care choices. And, you know, so for $9.99, you can fix any problem you have. In that kind of culture, it's very hard to even hear the gospel. And I think Benedict not only proclaimed the gospel in its fullness, in its integrity, with all the theological nuance his incredible mind was able to bring, but this is a very accessible way if people have ears to hear. And I think we in the West just don't have those ears to hear anymore the way they do in the third world.
Professor Madden?
And let me just jump in here on and add to what Mr. Winter said. Your colleague John Allen years ago characterized the difference between John Paul II and Benedict XVI this way, that John Paul II was the Pope of the visual age, that with visuals in front of large crowds, with grand gestures, he attracted the huge audiences that were amazed by what they saw. But Pope Benedict is the Pope of the Internet age, where with a few clicks of your mouse, you can find the text of an address that he gave, whether it's a Wednesday audience in front of the faithful in St. Peter Square or in front of a grouping of academics in Regensburg, Germany, in the fall of 06, or in front of assembled individuals at the Westminster Hall just a few years ago, et cetera. And you can download it, print it out, read it, ponder it, and see the surprising, what I would say over and over again, the surprising challenge that he poses, especially to people of the West, right? Saying, for example, he said to the French in Lourdes a few years ago that at the essence of French culture is theology, right? Benedict chose his name precisely as a statement to Europe that they need to return to their Christian roots or to be reminded of their Christian heritage and their Christian roots. And he addressed that issue over and over again. So I would say to anyone who views the papacy or views the Catholic Church as left wing, right wing, old guard, new guard, I would just invite those people, go to the website, find the addresses that this Pope has given, read them and think about them.
You know, interestingly, when I was reading about him, he's known in some circles as the Green Pope, who talks of caring for creation. And he cloaks it in that idea, in that concept. But clearly, I mean, one of the halls of the Vatican has solar panels on it now. Any particular distinction here for you, Michael Winters, or is it just, you know, something any pope says?
No, I think, well, first of all, this was one of the areas where his teaching really developed the teaching of the church. John Paul did not really address this issue in its fullness. And Benedict has again and again hammered away on these themes and, you know, sent a message to the climate conference in Durban. And again, primarily challenging the West and its lifestyle, and reminding people that, you know, if there were an environmental catastrophe, as if there's an economic catastrophe, it's always the poor who are harmed the most. So I think this was a new development. And yet, how did he develop the teaching? He went right back to some of our core, most foundational biblical texts about creation and our relationship with creation. So This is how the church develops. It doesn't just find something, you know, you don't just turn to the op-ed pages of the New York Times and say, oh, there's a good idea. You go back into the tradition. This is what happened at Vatican II. You went back to the, you know, early church fathers, back to the scriptures to find your core again. And I think this is something that was needed then. And I think we've come to realize it's something that is needed always. Benedict's great gift, I think, intellectually, as Professor Madden was saying, was just the range of the intellectual imagination that he brought to those tasks. And he could frame issues in ways people had not looked at a different way. The only other thing I really want to point out on, because we haven't gone to it, and I think it's a key difference, and I do think it was a shadow over all of Benedict's papacy. We are still paying the price for the fact that it turns out John Paul II was not always a good judge of character. And he chose some very bad assistants, and he put in position some bishops throughout the world who are either not very bright, who I think have a kind of reactionary interpretation of the modern world that he did not necessarily share himself and that Benedict certainly did not share. But, you know, it's the church. You are stuck with the personnel that you get from your predecessor. We're still paying for that. Certainly in America, I think there's been a decline in the kind of intellectual capability of the U.S. Conference of Bishops. And you've seen that over the last 20 years. And I, for all that John Paul did and bringing the gospel to these little countries where the idea that a pope would come and visit them and make them feel important and loved, I don't take anything away from that. But there were some very disastrous appointments there.
So there's 203 cardinals from 69 countries. Are they all on their way to the Vatican right now, barring the people we've already mentioned who definitely are not on their way? How many will be there and how many will engage in this conversation?
Well, let me just speak
Professor
about
Madden,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, according to the law, the only cardinals who can be in the room to select the next Bishop of Rome are those that are under the age of 80. There may be in Rome many other cardinals over the age of 80 offering moral support and collegiality and prayer, but those in the room are those under the age of 80. Many of them have already made their way to Rome. The official announcement that all the cardinals must come to Rome, this official announcement will come on Friday when, you know, by 8 p.m. Tomorrow night, the seat will be officially vacant. And then Friday, the announcement will be made around the world. And I think the cardinal and next week, and who knows how much beyond next week, the cardinals will meet in a room and hear speeches from members in the grouping of cardinals on what are the major issues facing the Catholic Church. And this will be a way in which these cardinals can sift through all of the issues and that will help guide their thought process for choosing the successor. The total number of cardinals who will be in the conclave is 115.
Okay.
Pope Benedict issued a decree recently that no matter what, no matter how long it takes, selection requires a supermajority, 2/3.
You know, Michael Winters, when you were talking about comparing all of this to sequestration, it's kind of scary sounding when you put it that way, that everything sort of shuts down until they get the new pope.
Oh, absolutely. And
I didn't know that.
I think Professor Madden was right in drawing this distinction between the under 80 and over 80. Some of the cardinals who are over 80 will be very influential in this process. All the cardinals will be involved in the meetings that start on Friday and continue until the formal beginning of the conclave. And my sources tell me that there is a real desire to move it up about a week. The original day they were talking March 15th. Now I'm hearing they want to move it up about a week. And because, you know, these guys have all been on the phone with each other now for 3 weeks. So when they start gathering, either starting on Friday or Monday, as Professor Madden said, they will start getting reports on the state of the church that were prepared by the Vatican Secretary of State. They will all get biographies of each other. And all the cardinals are involved in those meetings above and under 80 years old. It is only when the actual conclave starts that those who are over 80 are not invited into the Sistine Chapel, but their influence will still be set. For example, the meetings that start on Friday will be led by Cardinal Sedano, who is the Dean of the College of Cardinals. he is over 80, so he cannot go into the conclave. The vice dean is also over 80, Cardinal Lechuguadai, so he can't go into the Sistine Chapel. So it then falls to the senior cardinal bishop, who is Giovanni Battista Re. Well, guess what? Cardinal Re is very, very good friend and a longtime collaborator with Cardinal Sedano. So even though Sedano is not in the room, his best friend is in the room. So the influence will still have been there.
Yeah, they may be bench warmers, but yeah.
They will have mapped out a strategy. You know, we want this guy, and if he fails, here's our number two candidate. If we still can't get it, you know, if it goes to a day three or day four, then all bets are off. You know, and you never know how something is going to play out. And some people do anticipate this could be a longer conclave than we've seen since 1958.
Okay, so we only have about a minute or so left. Any chance of an American, or is the Cardinal from Boston the only, you know, is that about it, Leo Madden, or there are other?
I've made my short list, and I'm sure Mr. Winters has made his short list. Uh-huh. The only American is on my short list is O'Malley.
From Boston.
Yes.
Right. What about you, Michael Winters?
I would say if we have a pope on the first or second day, it will either be Cardinal Sedano or Cardinal Lumesch, who's originally from Canada but is now the prefect of the Congregation for Bishops in Rome. Those are clearly the two leading candidates going in, both very strong theological ties to Benedict, very different personalities. If we go into a third day and there's no one, all bets are off. And I would say someone like Cardinal O'Malley, who at this point I think he would have a 2% chance or a 4% chance, that jumps to a 30 or 40% chance. If we're going into day three or day four, all bets are off. And then you could see something like, even though they don't want an American, they could swallow hard and select someone like Cardinal Sean. I still think it's an outside shot.
Does it bother you that you're on vacation during this period of time, Michael Winters?
I'm going back to the States tomorrow, and I'm very glad I missed a lot of these Italian news scandal stories, and so I'll be able to bring a little bit more perspective to them when I get home. But no, it's an exciting time in the church. I will, you know, Friday morning at Mass, we will no longer be praying for Benedict, our Pope. Hmm. That will be very sad. I was worried the day of his election because of his reputation, and I have grown to love this man and respect him. I think we will be reading what his teachings 100 years from now. I brought on vacation a copy of one of his books.
Okay. Well, Michael Sean Winters, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michael Winters is a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. Also, Professor Leo Madden, head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. Thanks for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
And to everybody else, thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.